time for a musical interlude, I think.
Stop, whoa, yes, wait a minute, Mr. Postman.
Wait,
Mr. Postman.
The Carpenters with Mr. Postman, a hit for them in 1975. What's it got to do with nature? Well, I'm about to tell you. So, do you have any relatives in the States? Do you live in the States? Are you listening there now? Did you ever order anything that came from the States? Did it have a stamp on it when it arrived or when you sent it? Was it handled by the United States Postal Service? So, if you go onto their website, the US Postal Service, Postal Facts will tell you that in 2023, 13.68 billion US postage stamps were printed and $3.96 billion in stamps and stamp product orders were received by mail. They go on. Postage stamps are miniature works of art, indeed they are, designed to reflect the American experience. Stamps highlight heroes, history, milestones, achievements, and natural wonders. There's a story behind every stamp, and indeed there is. This story has to do with the image of a leatherback turtle, which was taken by one of our contributors, marine scientist Rowan Byrne, originally from Howth, now living in the UK. Rowan has travelled extensively in an effort to conserve wildlife and has done a lot of work on marine turtles. And it was one of his pictures that was chosen for a set of stamps celebrating sea turtles and highlighting their endangered status. Rowan joins us now from his home in Cambridge. Rowan, first of all, congratulations. How on earth, of all the people and all the places in all the world, did you manage to have a stamp chosen by the US Postal Service?
Well, a couple of years ago now, I was contacted by colleagues through the US Postal Service, say they were putting together a new set of stamps to educate the diversity and beauty of endangered sea turtles. And if you had any photographs, and I have a few of them over the years, and I had one particular one of an endangered leatherback sea turtle hatchling running down the beaches of Dominica. And it's very crystal clear. It's fantastic. And you see everything about the turtles. And they said, could we use it? I said, no question at all, folks. And it's been immortalised now with another set, another five, a set of six, illustrating the sea turtles in the US coastal waters and their endangered status and highlighted them. And it's I still can't get over it, Derek. I mean, out of all the millions of photographs, that tens of millions that could have been chosen, that they found one by this Irish fellow over here who did a little bit of work around the world on sea turtles.
As you heard me say at the beginning there, Rowan, 13.68 billion stamps produced every year, equating to almost $4 billion worth of business. They must have paid you a fortune for that image.
I wish. No, there was very little involved. Derek, I would have done it for free. I've been a servant to sea turtles for many of my life, and I took all these photographs and I've been using them in all the materials and publications and papers. So, as I said, I was delighted to provide it free of charge, even just to be asked, Derek, to be honest.
Absolutely. Now, you spent a great deal of your working life in the early years anyway. That's how I met you first, working with sea turtles. So what is the plight of the leatherback turtle, and do we have them in Irish waters?
Yes, we do. Well, the plight of the leatherback sea turtles is as ever endangered, but they, in some elements, in some areas of the world, they are in the increase, especially with all the substantial projects that are going on in the Caribbean that I've been involved with and other peoples are leading on. They are in decline in the Pacific because you have two sort of subpopulations of the same species. You have the Atlantic leatherback and you have the Pacific leatherback. And of course, the larger the area, the more unregulated some of the fisheries are and the higher the bycatches. But yes, we have them in Irish waters. Closer to home, as in just across the water in Wales, I think it was in 1988, the largest leatherback ever caught to date, a male, was 916 kgs, about over 2,000 pounds, over a tonne in weight, was caught off Clarock, off the Welsh coast. It was still within the English Channel and the Irish Sea, and it's ended up in the National History Museum in Cardiff. And anybody who ever wanted to see the fantastic individuals that they are, and the size and the majesty of these creatures, you can go to the Cardiff Natural History Museum. But they regularly visit the Irish coast. They're elusive. They obviously come up for this area of the world for a small gelatinous marine organisms, siphonophores, but mostly jellyfish. So there's pretty sure that when any of your listeners are walking around the beaches of Howth or Killiney or the west or east coast or wherever, Donegal, and there's jellyfish about, you can be pretty sure that there's leatherbacks knocking about. But they're quite elusive, and they like deep water, and they only ever come to the surface for a breath of fresh air, for want of a better expression, and it's hard to see unless you're at sea. But you can see them from cliff tops as well as like marine mammals and things like that as well. But they are there, and it's part of their migratory route.
Rowan, it's Niall here. Congratulations on this amazing achievement. I'm really chuffed to know that so many people around the US and internationally are going to see your photograph on their mail.
Thinking, Niall, you must have sent lots of mail from the States because you studied out there.
I did. I was based in Cornell University for a while, and I did. I wrote a lot of letters home and sending people books and so on, and I wish I could have had a lovely turtle stamp to fly the flag for
sure
conservation.
You get one of your old mates to send you one.
I actually will do that.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
but the leatherback particularly, that of all the sea turtles, and I've been lucky to see a few over the years, the leatherback's probably my favourite. It's the biggest in the world, first of all, but it's also the one that looks like the ultimate swimming machine. They are the most streamlined and hydrodynamic of the sea turtles, and they're different from the others in that they're aptly named. Rather than having a hard shell, as most people think a turtle would, they have a leathery, ridged sort of shell with almost these go-faster stripes on it to help them to swim, these big front paddles and when on the flippers. And then the thing with them, of course, as well, is that like all of these sea turtles, they're incredibly docile as well. There's something very endearing about them as a group, these gentle giants of the sea. It's sad to think how endangered many species have become around the world, and it's great to hear about these conservation initiatives. And now, of course, Rowan, more and more people will be learning about this through your photograph.
Will it make any difference, you think, Rowan?
Without question, Derek, and you've all just educated myself with the amount of people who use the stamp. So even if you get 10% of that learning about sea turtles, that's amazing. That's a great step in the right direction. And as Niall pointed out, they're gentle giants, and they are so endearing. I mean, I've been on so many beaches with these animals, and when they first came up, I was like, I won't swear on the radio, but I was like, look at the size of that thing. It's like a dinosaur. It's colossal. And when they crawl out of the water and you see them and you see the length of the flippers, I mean, just to give you an idea, I mean, as far as you both can reach your arms from left to right, you extend your arms out, that's one of the widths, that's the width of a leatherback sea turtle. And the average length would be anything from 6 to 8 feet long from the tip of their nose, their snout, to the tip of their carapace at the back of their tail. I mean, that's just, it's a colossal animal, and he's half a ton in weight. They are, as Niall said, they are absolutely majestic creatures, and I implore anyone who ever gets a chance to see these critters on the beach, which is the most important time in their life cycle, go and see them. And I was blessed in Dominica to be part of a project still ongoing. And, you know, in certain circumstances, it's not all like this, but you could be sitting there having your dinner and then go out and hear a bell and you go out and see a leatherback sea turtle that existed in prehistoric times, you know, and had family there. But colossal animals, and all these projects that are going on are making a massive difference. And of course, these stamps, well, I hope a lot of fishermen use the stamps as well, because then they can help educate it too. But more tools are always very helpful.
Rowan, congratulations. Terry here. Tell me a little bit about the difficulties of underwater photography. Do you need a whole different set of cameras and lenses and that to get some wonderful shots underwater, as well as the ones that you can get on land?
You do, Terry. Not only before you get to the camera equipment, you need to be a good diver. You need to know how to be negatively and positively buoyant. In other words, just be able to stay still in the water. And the one thing I learned very early on in my career on underwater photography is controlling the bubbles. So when you exhale your CO2, you don't want it coming into the photograph still. Because you have the camera to your mask and you're taking a picture of the subject and your regulator is just below you. And I remember years ago, I took many photographs. That's going to be amazing. What's all that stuff? Oh, it's bubbles. Oh my God. I exhaled exactly at the moment I pressed the shutter. So before you even get to photography, it's about being able to control your breathing and control your balance. And then when you've got that sorted, making sure you don't scare the subject, even if it's a small seahorse or a small frogfish. And also you don't touch the reef, or you don't, you know, put your hand down to balance yourself. But the technology behind it is moving really fast. It's going into nanotechnology now. But I use a Olympus underwater systems with strobes, flash strobes either side. And then when you angle the strobes, it's very important as well to make sure that you don't completely blow up the subject. In other words, you just colour it with a very strong flash, or you angle the flash to give it the background scatter. And then, more importantly, if you're not stable in the water and you're touching the reef or you're near the seabed or any of the sediment and you've disturbed the sand, when you take a picture, the flash will light up all the backscatter and the sediment in the water. So it's there's a lot of things to do before you get there. And then, more importantly, and this is a sad lesson I learned very quickly on in my underwater career, was make sure your O-ring, which is a small piece of rubber that goes around the inside of the camera at the back and the lens, has just a normal bit of grease on it, O-ring grease. And you know what the irony is? Underwater photography has all the technology. It has all the technical stuff you can get with the equipment and the software and the hardware. But if you have a teeny weeny speck of grit, just a little bit of grit, anywhere on the aperture or the back of the camera where it's attached to the, where you've just put the grease on, it'll flood. And then that's the end of your camera. So even all this technology that's on board, and even all the new nano sizes of cameras, if you don't take care, it's almost like the oil in an engine. If you don't take care of it, then you're going to have a very expensive bill when you come up off that dive.
Richard.
Yes, the original armoured personnel carriers. They're cute. They were cute oars, the turtles, because back in the age of the dinosaurs, they opted for a rather curious strategy. That is, carry your house around with you on your back. And they're a very low metabolism. They can go for ages without food. So if things go wrong, you retreat into your house and you lock the door. And in the case of the great big leatherback, it's a tractor tire you have on top of you, effectively. And it is a very good strategy. And of course, how wise they were, because 66 million years ago, the dinosaurs are wiped out, leaving the sea and every place else wide open to them, and they thrived as a result, in all probability. Now, the leatherbacks we have here, do they come from the Caribbean or from South America? I believe there's a population breeding in the Gabon. Have we made any progress here? Because this is a true Irish species. It's a great privilege in Ireland that we have the second largest reptile in the world swimming around our shores, just as we have the second largest fish in the world, the Basking shark, swimming around our shores. So our ones, do they come from the Gabon, or do they cross from the Atlantic, from the Caribbean?
Well, it's intuitive that you asked me that, because in 2008 I did an exact study like that. I put satellite transmitters, what they call satellite delay relay loggers, SRDLs, on leatherbacks to do exactly that, to understand where these animals are coming from and what they're doing. And obviously I was doing on nesting females, so when they came up onto the beach I was able to deploy the transmitter on them. And I had two transmitters deployed and found from that the females that are nested in Dominique in the Caribbean, they did travel up to Ireland. After they'd finished nesting towards the end of the season, because we were able to map their distribution around the Caribbean, they did travel up to Ireland. And of course, it correlates with their migration and their need for sustenance and food at different times of the year. Obviously, they've been depleted after they've nested a number of times for a number of months in the Caribbean. And then they would come up on the jellyfish stocks that were up here in the North Atlantic and beyond. And what you'll find is that leatherbacks that leave the Caribbean actually will do post-nesting, after they've left nesting, do go to West Africa. You're absolutely right. And even they even go up to the Canadian waters and feed on up there as well. So they go across the North Atlantic Ridge. They work their way across to Western Africa. They do go up to the Bay of Biscay in France. And they work their way up actually into the English Channel, found off Wales, as I said, and then off the coast and even as far as Donegal and further north. Because one of the things that they can do, which is just utterly amazing, they have a countercurrent heat exchange system, which basically means they can regulate their body temperature depending on the coldness or the depth of the water. In other words, they'll keep their inner core warmer than their exterior and their internal organs, and they recirculate the heat around them, and given the environment that they're in. But you're right, these are leviathans of the deep that travel tens and thousands of kilometres around the world, and especially from the Caribbean to Ireland to Canada to Africa and even to South Africa and more. And this is why we need to understand more about where they go and what they do, because this is a shared problem in order to reduce bycatch. And if they're crossed, they don't know geographical boundaries or who's in charge of what water space. And this is why we all need to work together. So, yeah, it's more studies that involve the tracking of sea turtles. And I think if you go to seaturtle.org, there's a huge resource on that website that shows you countless numbers of studies across the world tracking all different species of sea turtles. And I would encourage some of your younger listeners to definitely go on board and even adopt one or two of the turtles and see where they're going every day and get updates.
It's interesting, Rowan, that the leatherback, I think uniquely, is able to generate its own internal body heat. Having been around for all those millennia, I would have thought that something as prescient as the leatherback or the turtle would have learned to do this earlier, and that we should have other turtles and other sea creatures generating their own body heat, because it gives you access to the coldest waters where the oxygen levels are very high and food is very abundant. It seems strange that they never bothered to do this, most turtles, the leatherback being the unique one, I think. Is that true anyway?
Well, yes, with heat, I mean, generating your own heat, you can lose heat in seawater very quickly. So they'd have to have a source of regenerative heat, to be honest with you, or continuous heat to keep them cool and keep them warm, depending on the type of waters that they're in. One of the ways that they do control their heat, particularly on land, maybe not when they're in sea, is that I've seen nesting leatherbacks on the beach, because it's hot, tropical, warm weather that they're going into. So they're leaving 20 degrees water into ambient atmospheric temperature of about 27, 28, sometimes a little bit hotter in the Caribbean nights. So what they do is, while they're not generating heat, they're trying to cool themselves down. So they flush the blood that's to the skin surface while they're on the beach. And this is why you'll see them become this rosy red hue on their skin. Their skin is like elephant skin. And you'll see that in between the skin, there's a lot of red, and they're actually flushing the warm blood to the skin surface to cool themselves down. And it's they actually do get very warm, obviously being quite large as well. But to keep themselves warm, as I said, they do have this countercurrent heat exchange system. But I think one of the things that they have evolved, which is the most important thing in their life cycle, obviously deposition of eggs, is to cool themselves down so they're not too stressed. So in some ways, they have a cooling system rather than a heating system that works in their advantage.
Rowan, talking of temperature and turtles, one of the very unusual things about them, which poses a risk to their survival, is that the sex of their offspring is determined by the temperature at which the egg was incubated on a beach. I know that if it's generally, I don't know exact temperatures off the top of my head, but I know if the cooler temperatures favour male offspring and the higher temperatures mean that the offspring will be female. Are we seeing these sex ratios becoming skewed in the leatherback turtle, and is that a big threat to their future existence, do you think?
It's a very, very pertinent question. I mean, the way I always remember this was hot chicks and cold males, because when the sand is hot, then you produce more females, as you say, and when the sand is cooler, it's generally around 50 or 60 degrees Fahrenheit, you get males coming out. Yes, you're right. This is a huge problem. With climate change, eroding beaches, with climate change and even plastics on the surface of the beach changing the core temperature of the surface of the sand, and the availability of nesting sites, again due to climate change, erosion and deposition and sea level rises, it is making a big difference. And of course, you have to, recent studies have shown that predominantly there's more males in certain species, greens and hawksbills, than there is in leatherbacks, and the idea being that it's highly competitive in order to procreate with a female leatherback now, because there's more males, and this is due to some of the reasons which I've outlined. But essentially that, and you know, when we put big developments on the coast, we're looking at areas that would cool the sand and shade the sand, and the temperature is key. So we're over that tipping point at the moment in certain species of sea turtles, and some of it's in the unknown, but the general consensus in the scientific community is very much that the sands are getting hotter due to temperature rises. I mean, as Derek mentioned, I was in Belize a couple of weeks ago, and they have extreme heat of 42 degrees periodically on the day, so much so that electrical components, which is why it was there for subsea cables, can't cope. So in actual fact, if you have sea turtle beaches, nesting beaches, exposed to daily 40 plus degrees Celsius, you're going to have an impact on any sea turtles that are there, that are in the sand. And of course, that will obviously make more females, but then you could have the gender bias skewed the other direction. So it's worrying times now, worrying times.
The last time we spoke to you, Rowan, you were working with the global engineering management and development consultants, Mott MacDonald. Are you still with them or you've moved on?
I'm now working with a company called Ocean Science Consulting in Dunbar, and I can't wait to really get my teeth into these things. I'm very much going to be working on, would you believe, unexploded ordnances and underwater noise and rig to reef projects. In other words, like, what are the oil reefs off Scotland going to do when they're defunct? Well, let's make them into a reef. Let's make them into a habitat that can aggregate fish and support biodiversity and maybe even support climate change. So yeah, it's over the next while, I'll be working on a number of projects with Ocean Science Consulting to develop a lot of understandings about the impacts of underwater noise and acoustics, and doing a lot of studies like that. And I'll probably be back to you again there, because I'll have a couple of other research projects that we're working on, and share them with you. But it would also do with marine mammals as well. So exciting times ahead, to be honest.
Absolutely. And once again, Rowan, on behalf of the entire nation of Ireland, congratulations. You're the first Irishman, to the best of our knowledge, to have an image chosen by the US Postal Service for their stamps. So well done to you.
Fantastic. Thank you, Derek. And thank you to you all.
And that's pretty much all we have time for tonight. My thanks to Aina Nealana, Richard Collins, Terry Flanagan and Niall Hatch. Earlier, we heard The Carpenters from 1975 with their number one hit, Mr. Postman. But originally, it was a hit for a group called The Marvelettes in 1961. Notable as the first Motown song to reach the number one position on the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. Until next week, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. Right.